Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. At 5:30, in 25 minutes, we'll be talking with Bill Salmon, senior White House correspondent for the Washington Times. He's authored that book called Misunderestimated about President George W. Bush. We'll talk about the presidential campaign and a little bit of presidential politics there in the very last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. today. Greg Kokel is our guest as we continue our conversation about hate crimes and hate speech. Greg, before the break, you had read the text of the Canada law about that made hate speech a crime. Mm-hmm. And three words stuck out to me. The words, any identifiable group.
Right.
Now, you make the point that one of the distinctive things and one of the troublesome things about hate crime legislation is this element. Talk about that, please.
Well, not all crimes of passion are actionable on this view of passing legislation against hate crimes. A hate crime is a crime of passion. In fact, you look in Webster's dictionary, and hate implies a feeling of great dislike or aversion, the bearing of malice. Well, there's a lot of different crimes. In fact, most crimes of passion seem to entail an aspect of malice, but those are not all actionable under hate crime legislation because they don't all involve what I choose to call, and I think this is an accurate way of putting it, Todd, a protected class of people. In other words, it's not hate per se, but it's hating a certain group. Now, I'm not an attorney, but as far as I can tell, groups as groups have not had standing before the law. If a group is a corporation, well, then the corporation is an individual person, so there's an individual there. But just amorphous groups don't have standing before the law. When you make an assault against someone, when you harm someone, there's a person involved, an individual. There isn't this amorphous group. And even in class action suits where you have a group involved, the presumption of the law is that all of the individuals in the class action have been harmed directly or assumed to be. They are not simply getting an award because they're a member of this amorphous class itself. Right now, we have certain types of hate are actionable, they're punishable, with certain types of groups. And they tend to be, as George Willis pointed out, penalties for particular government-disapproved states of mind. And so this is my concern. Where is it in our legal system that groups have legal standing? When you have an assault, there is a punishment for the assault. When you have an assault with a hate attitude, there's an additional punishment levied. The first punishment is a punishment for the crime committed against the individual, but the second punishment is for the crime levied against the group. And that's why I'm not surprised at all that in C-250, the Canadian bill that was passed in Parliament in April, that they actually have the language. Hatred against any identifiable group. That's the problem. You know, why are we punishing people for having hatred towards groups? So we got two problems there. The thought crime, which, as I pointed out earlier, requires thought police, it seems to me. And secondly, the crime is against what? Not an individual, but a group. And when do groups have standing like this in the court?
Now, it seems then that there's kind of a... We were talking about this during the break through the people here in the studio. During the break, we were talking off mic, and one of the individuals here said, what's the definition of hate here? Mm-hmm. It sounds as though it's emerging here, at least. It can be something as simple as disapproval, and if disapproval is directed at a certain group, then that would qualify as hate,
yeah,
according to this legislation.
Well, this is, and it's hard to speak for Canadian legislation and what they've talked about, but just looking at the trends of this kind of language, even in our own country, what does it mean when a person, what does one have to do to qualify for, quote-unquote, hatred here? Does there have to be malice? And the response is no. There doesn't have to be malice. There has to be an expressed opposition to something, any particular thing that relates to homosexuality. If you are not entirely in favor of what homosexuality entails and what it does and all liberties that homosexuals are asking for, If you are not fully approving of it, but in fact express some disapproval, that is being interpreted as hate. Now, even in our country, like I said earlier, Barbara Boxer used that very word in her comments regarding the Senate discussion of the amendment.
So the person who wants to know, before we let this spin completely out of control, how do we determine which groups are proper targets under hate crime legislation and which ones? Because I can cut the groups any way I want to.
That's right.
You know, I'm a ball-headed guy. I could try and...
I never knew that, Todd.
Well, by choice, not by nature.
It's your answer. The blade is your answer to Rogaine, huh?
Absolutely, yes. little rebellion there.
Yeah.
I hear about ball-headed guys all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now, granted, I am one by choice. I wasn't born that way. But why am I not a group?
Right. Right. Well, this is what you're doing is you're identifying all the additional liabilities to this kind of legislation. On its face, this legislation is illicit, as far as I'm concerned. It makes thought a crime. It's only certain types of malice that are criminalized. I mean, all these other things. But then you have all of these fudge words in here. What exactly is hatred? What exactly is the identifiable group, or who are these people? You know, what is the difference between private conversation and public conversation? All of these make these kinds of actions, all of these fudge words here, make these kinds of legal actions a fruitful area for further distortion and further abuse. And what is actually happening here? And this is the third point that I make in the piece, is that what ends up happening is that hate crime legislation is actually used as a justification for oppressing a certain group, of course, and that certain group are people like you and I, people who have principled objections against these kinds of things. Hate crime legislation actually encourages hostility towards one group of people, and that is Christians.
Now, also at work in this, you point this out in the article, and we've talked about this many times, but for the sake of clarity, also at work of this is a curious redefinition of the term tolerance.
Yes. Well, yeah, this is something people have got to understand if they're going to be able to follow this. It's kind of a shell game going on right now with this word tolerance. People say, Kokel, you're intolerant. All right. First of all, when they say that, I'm usually arguing a point. Like, say, for example, this particular issue that was discussed in the Senate the last couple of days, and they level this accusation against me for the position that I hold in favor of an amendment to sanctify marriage officially in this country in the way that the way it's been acknowledged for since the beginning of time, and people's response to my idea is to call me a name. Intolerant. So instead of trying to respond to my argument, my ideas, they just say, Kokel, you're mean. But it's worse than that. Not only is it an ad hominem, but it turns out to be dishonest. Because I then, the first thing that I do, and everybody else in my shoes, you should do the same thing. When anybody calls you intolerant, you have to ask for a definition. What do you mean by that? What do you mean, intolerant? If I ask them to explain it to you, and I'll tell you what intolerant means. You think you're right and they're wrong. All right? That's really what it comes down to. I think heterosexuality is right and homosexuality is wrong. So therefore, I'm intolerant. I'm intolerant because I think I'm right and they're wrong. Well, I do think I'm right, all right? But I've got reasons for it. I'm not just making it up, and it's not because I'm mean, for goodness sake. It's not because I'm bigoted or hateful. Listen to my words. Here's my arguments. I can explain what they are. But I have another question for the person who calls me intolerant based on that definition. And my question is simply this. Do you, in the things that you hold, in the beliefs that you have, do you think you're right over and against your contrary views to me, such that you are right and I am mistaken? Now, the answer to that question has got to be yes. This is why we're having the conversation. They think I'm wrong, and they're trying to correct me. All right? But that sets up an interesting final question. And that is, why is it, and this you'll see, springs the trap and shows the foolishness of this tolerance trick that people play. And the question is, why is it that when I think I'm right, I'm intolerant, but when you think you're right, you're just right. The fact is, based on their definition of intolerance, they are just as intolerant as I am. I think I'm right, they think they're right, but I'm the only one that gets to be called a name. No, I'm not complaining because I get called names. That's not, you know, I'm not a baby. I'm a grown up. I can live with that. The point I'm making is this kind of name calling is substituting for the kind of substantive discussion and debate that ought to be taking place with regards to these issues. It's this kind of name calling that Barbara Boxer manifests today when discussing her reaction to the debate in the Senate on the sanctity of marriage amendment, and it's a characteristic of this whole thing. Instead of addressing the issue, they call names, and they think that's all they have to do. It'll go away if we can just call names. This is what children do. When children don't get their way, they call names. And it's what people are doing all the time now. And the tolerance trick is just another way, a sophisticated way, a politically correct way of abusing somebody who disagrees with you. That's all it is.
It not only robs, it not only substitutes, as you say, for substantive debate, mm-hmm. but over time it appears that this kind of rhetoric also erodes the public's ability to think clearly about issues.
Of course it does. You know, why should we settle for Barbara Boxer's comments? This attempt is an attempt that promotes prejudice and fear and hatred. Barbara, did you listen to the debate? Did you listen to the discussion? Do you have an answer to the objections that were raised of a contentful form? This is not a substantive response. But what she does, it's just like parents with kids. If parents call names and have vices that they live out before their children will repeat the vices. She is basically telling her constituency that the appropriate way to deal with these kinds of issues is to call names. And don't be surprised then when people do that, and they do it all the time. You know, I just wish, it just stuns me, and I see this a lot nowadays, and it's troubling for me who wants to think carefully about the critical issues and think that others should be thinking carefully about these issues as well, to see how frequently mere name-calling has replaced reasonable debate. We should not be surprised then when young people learn how to call names, but they don't learn how to think.
So let's wrap up this phase of the conversation, because I would like to, with your permission, turn the tables a bit on you towards the end here and come back full circle to the whole federal marriage amendment and see and listen to you respond to some of the objections
sure,
that someone listening to us, this conversation, might have about that. Just to wrap this up, does moral condemnation of homosexuality, does it encourage gay bashing or hatred toward homosexuals?
Well, I don't see how it possibly can in itself. There are people who hate homosexuals, and therefore they're going to condemn homosexuality and are personally motivated because of vice in their own life to act on that and to bring physical harm. Okay, but the fact that one disagrees with homosexuality, the fact that one says this is wrong and should not be encouraged, does not in itself promote gay bashing. And as Al Rantel, who is a talk show host here in Los Angeles, on the ABC affiliate here, by the way, in other words, a secular station, he himself, a homosexual, he says that kind of reasoning would make AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, responsible every time a drunk got beat up in the alley. Well, they say drunkenness is bad, you got to overcome that, so then that means it's okay to beat up drunks. Well, this is ridiculous kind of thinking. Does the same thing work with regards to Christians who are against homosexuality? Is to oppose a Christian who's against homosexuality and say that they are wrong in their views, does that mean that now you're fomenting not only hate but violence against Christians? Of course not. This is really silly thinking, but it's just another little silly, powerful tool that bad-thinking people use against other bad-thinking people or with them to get them to rally on their side. It just simply doesn't follow if you think a thing is wrong that you're spreading hate.
Greg Kokel is our guest. We're talking about hate crimes and hate speech. In about 10 minutes, we'll be joined by Bill Salmon, senior White House correspondent for The Washington Times, to talk about the presidential campaign. Greg, in the last few minutes, let's see if we can bring this back full circle and return to the issue of the federal marriage amendment. Someone's
okay.
been listening in the course of this conversation. We talked about federal marriage amendment and then hate crimes and your criticisms against hate crime legislation. And they might say this: look, I am an opponent of that federal marriage amendment because it would legislate against thought. It would legislate against feelings like love and affection that homosexuals have for one another.
Well, I'd want that person to spell out for me how an amendment saying that marriage is between a man and a woman legislates their thinking and legislates their love. That requires them to spell this out. It certainly isn't obvious to me that that has anything to do with it. Keep in mind, as I described in the beginning, this is a policy question. In fact, you can address this without ever addressing the legitimacy of homosexuality as a sexual preference or the morality of it as a sexual preference. The question is not about what or why people make choices to couple with other people, either emotionally or sexually. The question is why the government should privilege a particular relationship, should privilege, protect, and restrict a particular relationship. And they have an interest in doing that with one kind of relationship, that is heterosexual, monogamous, long-term unions, because it is those kinds of relationships that produce the next generation. They have no interest in doing it with homosexuals. In other words, the government, listen, here you go. Here's what I'm saying. Government keeps their hands off of homosexual relations. Government, those guys can do whatever they want to do. Government's going to stay out. That's what I'm promoting with regards to this question. Liberty here for them, which is what they've said they've always wanted. Now all of a sudden they want the government to get into the process of telling them what the nature of their relationship is, but and approving of it in official fashion.
Okay, then someone says the Federal Marriage Amendment would, by defining marriage as a man and a woman, basically legislate against a class of people. That was one of your other points with hate crime legislation. And that class of people would be homosexual.
It doesn't legislate against them because it does nothing to them. When you legislate with regards to a class, that means you're taking a class and you're passing legislation that protects them in some way such that any action against them becomes a punishable action. All the state is saying here, and by the way, this is done all the time. You have laws with regards to teachers. You have laws with regards to attorneys. You have laws with all kinds of groups of people that are germane to that group. That is, laws that are appropriate because of the defining characteristics of the group that just don't even come into play with other groups who don't have those characteristics. Nobody would consider it, you know, since there are legal restrictions to attorney-client privilege or something, that because there are legal restrictions to that, that I, as a non-attorney, am somehow legislated against and they're leaving me out, this discussion doesn't entail me at all. I'm not involved in that. And by the same token, here, this is talking about what is the foundation of civilization. The foundation is marriage, family, parenthood. That's the foundation. That's what builds civilization. The government is protecting that. It's saying we are going to deal with that as a unique thing, and we're not going to act as if that's nothing. We are just affirming that that is something in particular, and it's important to affirm it that way because children get caught up in the process here, and this is really about protecting the next generation. If homosexuals want to walk down the aisle and pledge their troth until death do them part and have a honeymoon and have two men and a cake and set up housekeeping and have sex and will all their belongings to each other, and fine, let them do that. Nobody's stopping them from doing that. They're asking for more. They're asking for the state to sanction their relationship as if it were the exact same thing as a heterosexual relationship. And you do not treat unequals equally. And these two groups, homosexual relationships and heterosexual relationships, are unequal at the precise point of relevant discussion, the next generation. If the next generation is not involved in a relationship between two people, whether same-sex or not, the government doesn't care. It's not going to get involved in it. When children are involved, then it cares, and it ought to.
Then someone says, look, you expressed a concern there at the end that hate crimes legislation would actually exacerbate hostility toward Christians who hold a viewpoint about homosexuality.
That's right.
How is it then that a federal marriage amendment, if it were to pass defining a man and a woman as the only legitimate form of marriage, how would that not incite hatred toward gays?
Well, I guess the burden of proof is on homosexuals at that point to show me how it will incite. It's not my job to prove that it wouldn't. It's their job to show me how this could possibly incite hatred against them when we simply affirm officially what has been affirmed by every civilization since the beginning of time. In fact, one could argue quite the opposite. There is a lot more hostility towards homosexuals when homosexuals try to cram their views down everybody else's throat and use the law to do it, and that's what's going on right now. There is more hostility under these circumstances. I said that about Christians because it's quantifiable that Christian groups are directly coming under attack and under the scrutiny of law, not only implicitly here in this country, but explicitly now in Canada, for standing as Christians. In other words, saying the same thing that the Bible seems to say on at least a fair reading of it. Even if they were mistaken on it, and I don't think they are, Christians and the reading of homosexuality in the Bible, even if they were mistaken, at least it's a one could see that it's a fair reading. You could see how somebody would get that attitude reading the Bible. But just trying to be faithful in their religious sense with proclaiming the truth of it, not hurting anybody, just being willing to say, I think homosexuality is wrong. They are now being persecuted for that, and the government and these laws are being used in that fashion. And so we have de facto persecution on a group, Christians, because of hate crime legislation. We have no indication that the marriage amendment is going to create more hostility towards homosexuals. In fact, I think it's just quite the opposite. The more they try to cram their views down our throat in this way, the more hostility that creates.
Greg, with only 30 seconds before we have to go, you think a lot about this, and you think about it in these terms that we've been discussing here in this hour. Realistically, where do you expect this debate to go publicly? Not so much with regard to the federal marriage amendment, but given the dearth of critical thinking in our society and the preponderance of these bogus arguments in favor of gay marriage, do you have a lot of hope that it won't become a reality?
Well, I don't know if gay marriage, or actually it would be same-sex marriage is the appropriate term, because gays can already be married, they just can't marry the same sex. The issue is whether people can marry the same sex or not, and the government doesn't care what your sexual preference is. I don't know that same-sex marriage will be a reality, although it's highly likely, and it already is in Massachusetts. But I think the battle is really gone against us, partly because we haven't stood our ground on other things like divorce and premarital sex and stuff like that, and adultery. So it's hard for us to do it now. It's going to be tough because we have a very relativistic culture that has bought into these things, and they can't think for themselves. And the other side make it very easy, as Barbara Boxer did, to get our mind off the real issue and just call names.
Folks, you can receive Stand to Reason's free Solid Ground newsletter by calling 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or you can check out the website for Stand to Reason by going first to our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the section titled Links with Regular Guests. Scroll down, and you'll find a direct link to Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. Greg, thank you again for being our guest.
It's great talking to you, Todd. We'll see you next time.
Greg Kokel is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. He's co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Mid-Air. And he's also written an article in the latest Solid Ground newsletter. It's titled Why Hate Shouldn't Be a Crime. When we come back from this break, Bill Salmon joins us. Pretty much all we're going to be hearing about in the news, except for the war, perhaps a few occasional stories about what's going on in Iraq and elsewhere, are presidential politics. It's the nature of the news cycle that this is going to provide television and radio with the most fodder, and that's what the fodder we're going to be fed here. We're going to be talking about the presidential campaign with Bill Salmon, senior White House correspondent for the Washington Times, for the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. Listening to Issues, Etc.
The fascists of the 20th century have been dead for 60 years. But are their ideas, is their worldview still alive and well in the 21st century? How have the fascists' disregard for life, for truth, and for Orthodox Christianity survived into the postmodern era? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for July is called Modern Fascism, The Threat to the Judeo-Christian Worldview, by Issues, Etc. regular guest Dr. Gene Edward Veith. You can have Modern Fascism by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040. Or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find the Issues, Etc. book of the month for July, Modern Fascism. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
Race. Which one are you from?
Answers with Ken Ham.
co-author of the popular book, One Blood, The Biblical Answer to Racism. Well, Ken, is it really right to divide all people on Earth into different races?
Well, from a biblical perspective, there aren't any different biological races. The Bible makes it clear that all human beings are descendants of one man, Adam, and one woman, Eve. And the book of Acts in chapter 17 confirms this. This means that all humans are related and belong to the same one race. Now, even the scientists who recently mapped the human genome came to this conclusion. After looking at sets of genes from humans around the globe, they concluded there's only one race, the human race. This is an example of how real science confirmed what the Bible has stated all along. After giving a talk on this at a seminar, I was told that when a man filled out his government census form, he decided that to answer the question, "What race are you?" he put down Adams. I can just imagine the person who had to read the census form asking the question, "What in the world is this Adams race?" Many Christians haven't understood there's only one race of humans. It's because they've been influenced by evolutionary ideas to believe in different races. Sadly, this has even caused racist attitudes about people they falsely thought were from a lower race. You know, the Bible's right. There's only one race.
Ken Ham has more fascinating information to share about the origin of different people groups. Read his free booklet on our website, answersradio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Violence in the media can cause children to be violent in real life. A joint statement signed by the American Medical Association and five other professional organizations says, quote, "The conclusion of the public health community, based on over 30 years of research, is that viewing entertainment violence can lead to increases in aggressive behavior," end quote. Don't allow your children to watch violent TV shows or play violent video games. Remind your children that Jesus died on the cross so that His peace would fill our lives. With Jesus in our lives, there's no room for hatred, revenge, angry words, or violence of any kind, be it real or on the screen. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton. I bring you news and information, inspirational Christian favorites, and conversations with great guests Monday through Friday on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO. Plus, short features like, "By the Way," our thought for the day from the Reverend Paul Devanteer, Front Porch Parenting with Dr. Mary Mance Simon, commentary from Dr. Dale Meyer, it's the Meyer Minute, plus Your Creation Moment. Features on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO.
Disappointing to see the current leadership continue to repeat the hostile rhetoric that they have used, which really shows that they're not interested in a constructive dialogue.
That was White House Secretary Scott McClellan responding to questions on why President George W. Bush refused an invitation to speak at this week's NAACP convention. Of course, that's been in the news today. We're going to be talking about this during the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc., among other things pertaining to the presidential campaign, with Bill Salmon, senior White House correspondent for The Washington Times. He's authored this book. We just talked to him recently about his new book called Misunderestimated, The President Battles Terrorism, John Kerry, and the Bush Haters. He'll be joining us here in just a few minutes to discuss that and other issues, such as gay marriage. Is it a good idea for the president to stand behind a federal marriage amendment? Is his support going to win him support, or is it going to be make this harder on him? Because, of course, all the other politicians, for the most part, are running for the tall grass on this issue. They're all saying, for the most part, hey, I think that marriage should be between a man and a woman, but that's all the more I'm going to say. I don't know if we should have a federal marriage amendment. And so they run for the tall grass. The president has decided to stick his head up and say, yes, I believe that marriage should be a man and a woman, and I'm going to stand for the federal marriage amendment as well. We're going to talk a little bit about the battleground states where the president is working hard to win votes. We'll also talk about, well, was it just last week that the president issued a statement? And he actually made a statement to the press that that while we haven't found any evidence of weapons of mass destruction, there was still the capability of producing weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. and that Saddam Hussein would have been capable of producing them and giving them to terrorists. What do you make of that position? Is that a backing off from his previous positions here? And we'll also be talking about the choice of John Edwards as the running mate for John Kerry in the course of this last 25 minutes of Issues, etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Now, before the break, I mentioned that if you watch television and listen to the radio, and I hope we're not contributing too much to the pile-on here, but if you watch television and listen to the radio, go on the internet to your favorite news sites, the top story is generally always going to be one of two things, either the war or the presidential campaign. And depending on how those stories are coming out, they're going to just bob like a seesaw above the surface for people to notice. And you might get the impression that nothing else is going on in the United States. This is the nature of the news cycle. It's the nature of the way the stories are going to run now. It's going to push other things off the front pages, off the television screen. Now, by the time we get to November, we're all going to be very tired of this. By the time we get, and it happens all the time, but with the increased spread of information and sources of information, just the other day I was talking to someone before we went on the air, and he showed me his little Palm Pilot, and he showed how he could just through with his little, it's not a Palm Pilot, some other little PDA, just touch this and touch that, and voila, he's on the web. Boom. He doesn't have to go home. He doesn't have to sit down. Wherever he is, in the bathroom, on the train, in the car, he can be on the web, anywhere he wants to be. We have access to this information. Are we getting good information? By the time we get to November, of course, good or bad information, we're going to be sick and tired of all of this. But we do have to talk about this, not only to be well informed, but also, you know, someone stopped me at the 62nd regular convention of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. They say, do you have to do a lot of reading and studying to do the radio program? And I said, yeah, that's pretty much all I do. When I'm not on the microphone, that's pretty much all I'm doing. If I'm not doing that, then I'm writing something. It's all information in, information out. Well, why do I do that? I do that because it's necessary for this conversation to take place 3 hours every day. It may not be what we want to talk about. Remember I said before, if I could snap my fingers or wave my hand and make the whole issue of gay marriage go away, I wouldn't want to be talking about it. But because that's what's necessary, we don't choose our battles and we don't choose our issues. They choose us. Tomorrow on the program, by the way, Pastor Will Whedon will be our guest. We're going to start a series with him on the early church fathers and the Reformation solas. Now, you may not have heard Sunday night's program when we talked with Pastor Whedon on this issue in a two-hour conversation. We're starting this series for our local listeners here. The solas of grace alone, that's what sola means. Faith alone, Christ alone, Scripture alone. Are these simply 16th century novelties dreamt up by Luther and his buddies? Or are these what the church has taught, recognized, having Scripture taught from the very beginning? We're going to answer that question one by one, week by week, with Pastor Will Whedon in the series that we begin with him tomorrow on the early church fathers and the solas of the Reformation. We'll begin with grace alone tomorrow on Issues, etc. Now, we don't do this so that you can escape from your humdrum life by listening to a little theology. Theology is not a means of escape. It's dead serious business. What Christians have believed is relevant to us today because it is what we ought to be believing today as well. So we're going to be starting that series with Pastor Will Whedon on the solas of the Reformation. Grace alone, well, that's where we'll start. Faith alone, Christ alone, and Scripture alone. Then Sunday night on the program, Pastor Mike Horton, Dr. Mike Horton, will join us from the White Horse Inn. We're going to talk about the Ten Commandments. Does God demand perfect obedience in His Ten Commandments? If He does, where is that obedience to be found? In you or someone else? And have the Ten Commandments, for all the carping that evangelicals have done about the removal of the Ten Commandments from the courtroom and judicial houses, have the Ten Commandments effectively been removed by those evangelicals themselves from their own churches? We'll talk about it Sunday night on Issues Etc. That's 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Mike Horton and the Ten Commandments Sunday night on the program. Bill Salmon will join us here in just a moment. We're going to talk about the presidential campaign. Not only George W. Bush, that's his area of expertise, but also John Kerry. Bill Salmon is senior White House correspondent for the Washington Times. We talked to him recently about his book, Misunderestimated, The President Battles Terrorism, John Kerry, and the Bush Haters. You know, the Christian looks out on the public square, and there are times when you want to escape from all of it. There are times when you want to say, I don't want to have to worry about any of that anymore. We don't have that luxury. We simply don't. We talk about two-kingdom theology quite a bit here on Issues, etc. We talked about it recently with Pastor Mark Sell. Why do Christians need to know what's going on in the world around them? Simply be so they can be interested and well-informed citizens? That's part of it. But there's a more essential thing about knowing what's going on in the world around you. It has to do with you have to live in this world. I said before we don't get to choose the issues or the battles that we fight. We don't get to choose the world we live in. We don't get to decide what world we're going to live in. God says, this is the world I've put you in. This is the one you will live in. So the Christian doesn't have a choice as to whether he lives in the right-hand kingdom, God's church, where he rules by grace through his word toward the ends of saving sinners, or whether he lives in God's left-hand kingdom, where things are messy, where it's full of compromise, where we have to deal with issues like federal marriage amendments. When we'd like to just be able to take the Bible, lay it open on a table and say, everyone believe this, and the problem is solved. It simply doesn't work that way there in the left-hand kingdom, does it? Be nice if it did, but it doesn't. So the Christian needs to be engaged in both. He needs to engage in those kind of critical thinking skills that we try and teach when we talk with Greg Kokel, not only for the right-hand kingdom, but for the left-hand kingdom as well. So that when he stands in the left-hand kingdom as a citizen, well-informed, he not only has his facts straight, but he's also able to think clearly about those facts and articulate them clearly and argue contrary opinions, argue against contrary opinions with those facts. I was talking recently with one of my pastors, and we were talking about the pro-life issue. And he had come talking to me about an unrelated thing, and we got off on the pro-life issue, and we got off on the whole issue of worldviews. In the course of this conversation, it became clear that what is lacking often among Christians is kind of the a threefold way of dealing with the world. Do we know what we believe? That's the most basic level here. Do we know what we believe? Are we able to articulate what we believe? That's the second level. And thirdly, and not least, are we able to defend and argue what we believe to someone who doesn't believe it? You see, if Christians don't know what it is they believe, they're not going to be able to do the other two things. Christians that don't know what they believe aren't able to articulate it. We find this all over the place. Christians who say, well, I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to believe. And then when they find out that what Christians do believe, it sounds odd to them. If a Christian knows what he believes, he can still be unable to articulate it. He can't put it into words. How often has this happened to you? Well, I know what I believe, but I can't say it. That's what people find valuable about this program. They say, you gave me a way of saying what it is I believed before. I believed it, but I wasn't able to put it into those words so clearly that it made sense. And once a Christian is able to both know what it is he believes and articulate what it is he believes, then the task is to not only articulate it, but also to argue for it with people who don't believe that. For the remainder of this program, we're going to be talking with Bill Salmon. He's senior White House correspondent for the Washington Times. We're going to talk about the presidential campaign. Bill, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Todd.
Bill, very recently the president declined an invitation to the NAACP to speak at their national convention, and he's been catching a lot of heat for it, both from the NAACP and from his political opponents. Was this a mistake?
I don't think so. I think the NAACP has shown itself to be such an overtly partisan Democratic organ that it would have been a no-win situation for President Bush to show up there. He would have gotten booed. He would have gotten treated shabbily. There's no way in the world President Bush is ever going to win over the NAACP leadership. They are actively working to defeat him. So, I he's decided that he's going to go to the Urban League, another civil rights organization instead, which is a little bit more moderate, and I think that's probably a smart move.
Now, we were talking about this before the program, and we were thinking, had he gone and, yes, been booed and treated shabbily, does he then have the opportunity to kind of show his political opponents as uncouth, kind of the Michael Moore's America at work there?
I think he already is able to do that without going. I mean, you saw what happened when he declined the invitation. Julian Bond and Kwesi Mfumi, the leaders of the NAACP, savaged him. They talked about, Republican Party being the dark underbelly of American politics. They accused Republicans of playing the race card in every single election. They accused black conservatives of being, quote, ventriloquist dummies, end quote, which prompted a response today from Rod Page, who, of course, is the black Secretary of Education. He wrote an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal taking strong issue with that and saying that the NAACP does not have the right to speak for all blacks in terms of politics.
We're having a debate in Washington, and it needs to be a very sensitive, thoughtful debate as to the nature of family. I have made my position clear. I believe that a traditional marriage, marriage between a man and woman, is an important part of stable families.
Now, Bill, that was President Bush speaking yesterday at a campaign stop in Wisconsin, talking about his support for the federal marriage amendment that would define marriage as between a man and a woman. The president finally came out in favor of this. Is this something that is going to help him or hurt him ultimately in the presidential campaign?
I think it'll probably help him, and here's why. I think most Americans favor defining marriage as between a man and a woman. And it's also a way for him to sort of get his base out, get his conservative base voters out. He's also pushing the abortion button a lot in the last few days, which is something he hasn't pushed as president. But now that he's running for re-election, we're seeing abortion, not just abortion itself, such as late-term abortion, but he's talking about parental notification of teenage abortions. He's talking about the morning-after pill. And he's saying that John Kerry has voted on the wrong sides of all of these abortion-related issues, which is part of the culture wars. The gay marriage, abortion, gun control, these kinds of things are all going to excite President Bush's Republican base, and that's a very important part of winning re-election.
So without a note of cynicism here, can we expect President George W. Bush to appear more conservative now that he's running for re-election than he did, say, through the course of his first term?
Well, he certainly is invoking conservative red meat issues more. And I think that is, I guess it is pretty political. I guess you could call it cynical. But in a larger sense, he also tries to take the high road on some issues as well. For example, the war on terrorism. He gave a speech the other day where he very forcefully laid out his defense of the war in Iraq, didn't really mention Kerry or Edwards by name. On the same day, Vice President Cheney was off on the campaign trail, and he had no compunction about really tearing into Edwards and Kerry by name. So it's almost sort of a good cop, bad cop routine that they've decided they're going to go with because, the vice president typically can be the lightning rod, can be the guy that feeds the red meat to the base, and Bush can at least partially take the higher road.
Could Cheney's outspokenness also be accounted for as kind of a reaction to what seems to be rumblings in the Republican ranks about whether or not Cheney should be the running mate for 2004?
Well, I got to tell you something. I have personally spoken with President Bush and Vice President Cheney about this issue. I spoke with President Bush at a press conference 2 days after the midterms and specifically and repeatedly asked him if Cheney was going to be on the ticket. And then I spoke with Vice President Cheney about 10 days ago on Air Force Two about this. And they are telling me in no uncertain terms, Cheney is the guy not only to run on this ticket, not only is he going to stay in it throughout this campaign, but if they win, I specifically asked Cheney, are you going to stay all 4 years of a second term should you win? Because a lot of people think he'll duck out after a couple of years, say the heart's not, you know, not really working well, and then you get somebody in there who could succeed President Bush. He said, absolutely not. I am in this thing to serve 4 more years.
Did anyone ask him about a Cheney, someone else ticket in 2008?
Well, you know, Cheney has professed no interest in the presidency. He did this. He flirted with running for president some years ago. It didn't really go well. He's not the greatest campaigner. And, in fact, had to really have his arm twisted by President Bush before he agreed to be vice president 4 years ago. And he has said all along, now, I guess in politics everybody can change their mind, but he has said all along and continues to maintain publicly that he has no interest in the presidency. The guy has had 4 heart attacks. He is over 60 years old. Not that, you know, I mean, Ronald Reagan was much older than that when he was elected. But I don't think it's in the cards for him to be president. I don't think he wants it, frankly.
We're talking with Bill Salmon, senior White House correspondent for The Washington Times and author of the new book titled Misunderestimated, The President Battles Terrorism, John Kerry and the Bush Haters. Bill, politically, would President Bush be better off with John McCain as his running mate?
No, and here's why. I mean, that's sort of one of these fantasy inside the beltway games that all the, you know, pundits love to play here in Washington, and what it would do is it would cause much more harm than good. Yeah, John McCain's a popular guy. I was out on the Straight Talk Express in 2000, that bus riding around with him, and I drank some of that Kool-Aid, and I was sort of, you know, caught up in that whole thing. And I admit it, but I just think that the price you would pay to win over some swing voters, which, by the way, is an increasingly small pool of voters, we're talking 7-8% at most. The price you would pay to peel off a couple voters there out of that pool would be a major potential erosion of the Republican base. You know, you can say a lot about George W. Bush, but the one thing he has going for him so far in this election is that he has not seen significant erosion of his base, very unlike his father. His father had Republicans deserting him left and right when he sought re-election in 1992. This president realizes the importance of this base and knows that if he gives Cheney the heave-ho, a lot of conservatives are going to just stay home.
Is the base going to be happy with the Republican National Convention? The word is that the speakers, the slate of speakers, are not going to be base kind of speakers. They're going to be more middle-of-the-road Republican speakers.
Well, you know, that may be the opportunity. You and I have talked a lot about, you know, exciting the base in the last weeks. But that may be the opportunity to reach out to them. I mean, at some point, you got to get both. I mean, you got to get your base, you got to get the swing voters. By contrast, the Democratic convention looks to be almost all hard left liberals. I mean, you know, you don't see a Joe Lieberman getting a speaking spot. You see Howard Dean, Hillary Clinton, you know, John Kerry, John Edwards, Teddy Kennedy, Al Gore. I mean, this is not the kind of lineup that you appeal to middle America with. This is the kind of lineup that you excite your base with. So maybe the Republicans have made the calculation that that's the time, that is their convention, to try to reach out to the swing voters.
What do you make of the choice of John Edwards as a running mate for John Kerry?
I think it was the best of the Democratic lot. And I say that because, as you know, John Kerry courted John McCain no fewer than 7 times. Of course, John McCain's a Republican, and clearly John McCain was John Kerry's first choice as vice president, which I think says something about the Democratic Party. If your top choice is a Republican, there's a problem there. But having said that, when McCain finally made it clear that he would not be the vice presidential running mate, I think John Kerry did pick the best available Democrat. And I know, you know, the negatives on Edwards, such as that he's the 4th most liberal member of the Senate, and that is a problem. But I do think he makes up for the charisma deficit of John Kerry. I think he represents the future face of the Democratic Party. He at least has the mannerisms of an optimist, although I would contend that his rhetoric, namely, you know, one of two Americas, is by definition divisive and therefore pessimistic. He at least gives off the smile and the hugs and the appearances of an optimist. I think that carries you a certain way in politics.
Finally, with only about a minute and a half here, what are the battleground states, but the of more particular interest to me, what are the must-win states for President George W. Bush?
Well, I mean, if you had to narrow it down to one, it would be my home state of Ohio, where I lived for 35 years. That's, by all accounts, the new Florida this year. Florida is still extraordinarily important. I would probably put it second in importance because it has 27 electoral votes, and it's extremely important for both candidates. Having said that, there's been a lot of talk lately about, you know, Edwards putting the South into play now that Edwards is on the ticket. I think it's hogwash. Edwards will not carry, will not allow Kerry to carry any southern states. Bush will carry them. I think the real battlegrounds in the Midwest and states like Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico.
And with regard to California and Florida, what do you expect the Bush ticket to do there?
I think Bush has a pretty good shot at taking Florida. Remember, in 2002 midterms, Terry McAuliffe said that Jeb Bush would never win Florida, and Jeb won by 13 points, re-election as governor. I think California is a longer shot. It's possible that they could win it, but if they win California, it's going to be a landslide for the Republicans.
How many debates for the presidential candidates and for the VP candidates, and what forum do you think they'll take?
Well, there are three debates for the presidential candidates. They take the format is one is the first one, I believe, is foreign policy. The second one is domestic policy, and I think the third one is basically a free for all. Whatever gets asked. And there is one debate for the vice presidential candidates, and that will be in my home city of Cleveland, Ohio, and that will be in October. They'll be very important this year because right now the horse race is locked up dead even, and those debates could break it open one way or the other.
Bill Salmon, thank you for being our guest.
Thanks for having me.
Bill Salmon is senior White House correspondent for the Washington Times. He has authored the book, it's new, Misunderestimated, The President Battles Terrorism, John Kerry and the Bush Haters. Friday on the program, that's tomorrow, Pastor Will Wheaton will join us to talk about the solas of the Reformation in the early church fathers. Dr. Mike Horton of the White Horse Inn will join us Sunday night to talk about the Ten Commandments. That's from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. And remember to tune in tonight from 8 to 9 for the rebroadcast of the first hour of Issues, Etc. here on AM 850 KFUO. In that first hour, Amy White was our guest talking about the Missouri Marriage Amendment, and we heard audio from the Senate debate on the Federal Marriage Amendment. That's from 8 to 9 tonight. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.